Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am here to talk about Capital Markets Union today with the two people in the think tank sphere who possibly know the most about it. Thomas Wieser, the former head of the European Commission's high-level group on capital markets, and Nicolas Véran, our Bruegel senior fellow and longtime writer on financial markets issues. Nicolas, why are we talking about capital markets today, given that it's been an issue since 2015?
Well, maybe we're talking about it today precisely because it's been an issue for 10 years. Mr. Juncker actually announced it in July 2014, and not that much has happened. I wouldn't say nothing has happened, but the delivery of policy outcomes has not been commensurate with the stated ambition. The ambition of Capital Markets Union is, that, as its name suggests, to unify Europe's capital markets and make them one financial space, particularly for securities, that would, in a nutshell, rival Wall Street, have sufficient depth and liquidity and scale to really provide a lot of value for new projects, be it startups, be it investment projects, be it other things that external funding on the capital markets. And this is easier said than done. So we have had a lot of saying and not a lot of doing. We have had a lot of lip service by political leaders and officials about the benefits that the Capital Markets Union would bring to the European Union. And I think everybody agrees with that. It would make the EU more resilient from a financial point of view. This is why the ECB likes it a lot. It would promote certain aspects of the growth agenda, especially in terms of high growth firms. It would provide financial firepower for certain aspects of the green transition, for the financing of some private sector projects in the transition to mitigate and adapt to climate change. So all this is kind of motherhood and apple pie, as they say in the US. Everybody agrees it's good. But when it comes to action, there have been a number of decisions in the last 10 years, new legislation, things like very arcane things like the single access points for corporate information, consolidated tape for transactions data, things like that. They're not transformative. They're useful. They're in line with what the Commission has always done in terms of internal market for financial services, but they don't match the stated ambition of the Capital Markets Union slogan. And after 10 years, at the moment when the EU feels left behind in matters of productivity, in matters of global leading firms, especially in tech and AI and what have you, there is a greater sense of urgency that basically we have been talking about it for a long time, but not reaping a lot of results. So I think that's one of the reasons why we see more attention to this project right now. And also, of course, the run-up to a new term at the EU level, a new commission that could provide new impetus on some of those aspects.
We're hearing a lot about Capital Markets Union as one of the ways to increase scale-up funding to help European companies find the money to go from small and promising to bigger and more globally competitive. One of the things that keeps coming up is how there are 27 different markets rather than one unified market. The think tank New Financial has found that there are something like 40 exchanges and securities depositories and repositories and clearinghouses and things, as opposed to the US, where the total of all of those is more like 10 in ballpark terms. Thomas, your group tried really hard to make concrete recommendations about ways to move this forward, as opposed to just saying, we want more coordination. You're still out there helping the finance ministers figure out what to do. What did you tell them the last time you spoke to them?
Thanks very much, Rebecca. I'll just pick up some of the thoughts that Nicola laid out. Now, it's called Capital Markets Union and not Capital Market Union. So there's a recognition that there are 27 national capital markets, or there should be. And I've sort of tried to paint a picture of what this looks like in Europe. And for me, it's like a house with 27 different rooms. Some of them are fairly large, and they've got good plumbing and good lighting. and others are small and dark, and the plumbing is very antiquated. And the doors between the 27 different rooms are of different width, so it's not too easy to get from one room to the other. And over this is the roof. The roof is the European Union. And the roof is sometimes better and sometimes leaky. So what does this picture tell us? A house which only consists of a roof is not a house. And a house which consists only of 27 different rooms but has no decent roof is not a house. So we need to work from the top and we need to work bottom up. And I'll start maybe with the bottom up. The supply of long-term capital and the demand for long-term capital differs enormously between the different member states. And I think one of the most important points is how do we look at our pension systems? Countries which do not only have pay-as-you-go pension systems, but pension funds, fully funded pension systems, they usually have vibrant, dynamic, and deep capital markets. Take, for example, the Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, and, of course, the UK, which has a European history. Then you've got countries with predominantly pay-as-you-go systems, Austria, Germany, and others, and that is where capital markets tend to be rather weak. So what we need to do is to push forward so that national capital markets get stronger, because you don't want to link up 27 semi-strong and very weak capital markets to each other. Then the roof doesn't really serve a decent purpose. On the other hand, the roof, if we don't make progress, for example, on tax issues, if we don't make progress on more unified supervision and a couple of other issues, then getting stronger at the national level will be fine, but it will never become a European capital markets union. So we need to work from the bottom, we need to work from the top, and we need to recognize that with the challenges of climate change, digitalization, etc., bank funding, loan financing is fine for a number of issues, but not for the most pressing issues of the 21st century.
So we need more stock markets, more bond markets, more other types of non-bank loan financial market activity. The Capital Markets Union wish list has included everything from changing the tax treatment of debt versus equity to looking at insolvency laws to, as you mentioned, the pension systems. Nicola, which of these are possible to move forward on? You've made the case that finance regulators need to focus first on things they can do within the finance space. What does that look like?
I will pick it up where Thomas has left it, because I agree with him. I wouldn't say you need national capital markets. I think you need national enablers of capital markets. You need the framework conditions for capital markets development to be there. And on a number of issues, like Thomas mentioned, these framework conditions are set at the national level. So I think one of the mistakes that were made, also by analysts, by the way, including myself, was to believe that on these issues that are set at the national level, taxation, pension finance, insolvency law, I would add housing finance, which, as we see in the US, can be a very powerful driver of capital markets development and securitization. I think the mistake was to think that the EU can play a big role in driving those issues. Actually, it cannot. It has tried. It has failed. This is beyond the EU's reach because of the obvious political dimensions of each and every one of those policies and the fact that at the current stage of the EU legal and political architecture, basically the EU has no leverage. Insolvency law reform is a very good example, but the other ones similarly. Where the EU does have leverage is in financial services policy, because a transition started 20 or so years ago, even before the great financial crisis, of course, accelerated powerfully by the Eurozone crisis, when Thomas was at the Eurogroup and catalyzed a number of very important developments. And now we have broad-based acceptance that in this area of financial services policy, which includes prudential regulation and financial investor protection, consumer protection regulation, this is basically EU turf. This is where the EU has instruments, and there is general acceptance that EU law determines the basic elements of policy. And you see, this transition is unfinished. Of course, we talk all the time about the unfinished banking unions. That's a good example. But I would say the proposition that the locus for that kind of policy space is at the EU level more than at the national level, that proposition has won the day. And therefore, there is more leverage for the EU to make a difference. So to rephrase a little bit what Thomas has said, I would say EU financial services policy can advance the cause of capital markets union. And maybe we'll talk about, for example, supervisory integration in that context. On the other drivers, the individual rooms that Thomas described, pension, insolvency law, taxation, housing finance, it's really a matter for the member states. The EU can provide benchmarking, it can provide transparency, it can provide comparison and mapping, but it cannot provide decision. And I think that distinction has to become sharper for us to make progress on capital markets union.
Thomas, what would you add to that?
I would not disagree with Nicola, but we've got to remember Brussels consists of more than just the Commission. And what Nicola was talking about now was sort of legislative processes initiated by the Commission and then decided upon by Council and European Parliament. But we do have quite a number of policy fields where the same issue happens to be the case. And nevertheless, member states are able to produce a process of convergence simply by benchmarking each other, by having peer review processes, by discussing these issues. And things really move forward if heads of state or government take ownership of these issues. As it happens, over the last decade, finance ministers, but also heads of state, when in Brussels or when on Sunday we're talking about capital markets union, we're incredibly enthusiastic and say, yes, go for it. We've got to move this forward. And as soon as they'd had a nice glass of wine or went back home, they completely forgot about it. So what we need is the driving force of heads of state who really take ownership and task members of their government to move this forward. So that would be an important point and possibly a slight qualifier to what Nicola was saying. Second point, now that we've realized how difficult it is to move things forward amongst the 27, on some issues more than on others, one may want to consider if intensified regional cooperation would not be possible in a couple of areas. Think, for example, on Central Europe having better cooperation on stock exchanges. As you mentioned, Rebecca, Europe hosts a couple of different exchanges, and one which I could reach here from Vienna by bicycle hasn't had a single IPO in its lifetime. So what's the use of every member state insisting on having their own stock exchange, which is organizationally completely independent from all others? Bunch this together, have local antennas, which are important for national companies that want to go public, but forget about this very old-fashioned idea of each and every country having its own totally independent stock exchange. Just as one example of what one could do better at the regional level instead of at the national level.
When we come back, we'll talk about common supervision and how we might be able to move forward on that. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Leaders are meeting in Brussels. The euro area leaders specifically will get together on Friday to talk about how to move capital markets union forward. Single supervision, common supervision, like what they've done with the banks, might be a great way to bring standards together for some convergence and also hopefully look out for more safety and soundness. Nicola, what would you like to see from the leaders to make that happen and what would be the steps to get there?
So the good news on this debate on supervision is that it has different terms now compared to, say, 10 years ago when Capital Markets Union was coined as a slogan by Jean-Claude Juncker, let alone 15 years ago before the Eurozone crisis forced the centralization of supervision in the banking sector through European banking supervision at the ECB. And the difference is that now we have proofs of concept. And especially European banking supervision, also known as a single supervisory mechanism, the work of joint supervisory teams that bring together ECB staff, national authority staff, the decision-making is centralized at the ECB. This system works. The banking union is unfinished, but the supervisory piece of the banking union is basically complete, and it works very satisfactorily. Of course, there are always risks. It could become complacent. It could become overly bureaucratic. Some people say it already is overly bureaucratic. But when you compare it in terms of supervisory effectiveness, even compared with the U.S., which used to be the best standard, we saw the regional banking crisis in the U.S. a year ago, the ECB looked better in the presence of a similar financial shock of rising interest rates. So that's a proof of concept. And now we have other experimentations. The Single Resolution Board is also a supervisor, even though it's not its main job. The Anti-Money Laundering Authority has been decided. The legislation is coming up soon. It will be up and running next year. It will become a direct supervisor of some entities later in the decade. So now the idea that you have at the EU level a supranational supervisor that is effective, that is credible, that is independent, it's not utopian because it exists. And that changes the terms of the debate. Now, for capital markets, what do we have? We have ESMA, so European Securities and Markets Authority. I'm constrained about talking about ESMA because I have to disclose I'm an independent non-executive director of an entity that is supervised by ESMA, the EU arm of the trade repository of DTCC. That's a mouthful. So that's a Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. It's a tiny piece of financial infrastructure. It doesn't really color my judgment, or at least I hope that way, but I have to mention it. So ESMA is a bit of a work in progress as a supervisor. It is doesn't have autonomous funding. It has a governance framework that basically doesn't work very well because it's governed by, long story short, by a board of supervisors of individual national authorities. And as Thomas mentioned, some of the countries out there really don't have a lot of that activity of securities and markets. So giving the decision to a qualified majority or majority of national authorities is really not the way to go because wholesale markets have a way to concentrate in a limited number of financial centers. And that means the authority that have those financial centers compete against each other for financial center activity. And the authorities which don't have those financial centers basically are clueless. And therefore, they will vote on the basis of considerations that have nothing to do with the case at hand, will be basically diplomatic and not substantial. So ESMA does supervise some entities. They are minor market segments at this point, but it's not really engineered to be an authoritative, independent supervisor. And I think this is where the core of the debate lies. It's kind of not cool because this is about the, you know, the deck chairs on the Titanic, the institutional setup. But that's where a lot of the debate is on making capital markets union a reality from a financial services policy perspective at the EU level.
One of the fears that countries often say about giving up control of specialties like this to supranational supervisors, they say, well, what if we do hit the iceberg? What if there's a crisis? We at the national level will still be tasked with fixing this. I would argue that the EU comes together when necessary to come up with solutions, and also that having coordinated supervision, if it comes with real data sharing and real coordination with other people working on financial stability like the ECB, might go to protect financial stability in the first place. But Thomas, what would you say about that? Can we convince the national regulators to hand over their information and their trust in keeping the system safe?
If we remember how the single supervisory mechanism for banks came about, that was back in 2012. Funny things were happening in markets at that stage. And there were a multitude of problems which we could trade off one against each other and come up with an innovative solution. And as a matter of fact, we found agreement in the course of an evening. The times were dire enough for that. Now, I've been discussing the issue of supervision with dozens of people, if not hundreds of people. And one of the most peculiar arguments I heard from a stock exchange was when the CEO said, well, you know, we love our supervisor because our supervisor loves us. And we don't want to change somebody who loves us for somebody we don't know, i.e. a European supervisor. So that to me shows that there is a fairly unhealthy proximity between the supervisors and the supervised, which a more European solution would do away with. So having more, coming back to your simile, Rebecca, having more Europe in convergent or joint supervision would actually clear away some of the icebergs. So you hit less icebergs. And if you actually do hit an iceberg, you've got more lifeboats around you than you otherwise would have. And there's still the illusion that every single little tiddly, unimportant entity would be supervised by ESMA, which is nonsense. As for banks, you would have a joint, convergent, single, whatever supervision of systemically important entities and leave the others to the national supervisor to supervise or not supervise as they see fit, because they would not have cross-border effects in the case of failure. Now, it's all very good to talk about what we'd love to see in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years time, or whenever, but joint, a single supervisor is not around the corner. So whatever produces a higher degree of convergence of rules, of processes, of procedures is good. Anything that somehow loosens the grip of 27 different national supervisors on the proceedings of ESMA is good. Anything that strengthens ESMA, therefore, is good. Anything that retains the status quo is bad. Moving forward at a pace which is somewhat beyond that of a snail is good. Fingers crossed.
I'd like to ask both of you about securitization, which is the next sort of technical file that people are talking about. The European Central Bank in its March statement on CMU said that this would be a great way to get risks off the balance sheets of banks. The Commission is also talking about securitization as a way to mobilize more capital. I'm really struck that this debate is always in terms of what it can do for banks and not what it can do for markets. Are we creating mutual funds? Are we creating better pension products that don't have weird names like UCITS, but that are things that regular people can understand and might want to invest in? What do you see are the opportunities of securitization, and what are the pitfalls if you do it wrong?
So before we get there, I'd like to just say one more word about our debate with Thomas on supervisory integration, because it's so important. I think our difference is really about how high the bar is for making progress in that area. And Thomas says the bar is as high as it was for banking. And in banking, we had a major crisis. And on this, we don't have a crisis, and therefore the bar is too high. In a way, I'm less pessimistic than he is, but he's wiser than I am and more experienced. The reason I'm less pessimistic goes back to one of your earlier points, Rebecca, which is the fiscal undertones of all this. I think when you think of prudential supervision of banks, it's obvious to everybody that at some point, member states have to spend money on bailing out banks or protecting deposits, and that requires national money. For capital markets, it's less clear, because there is more of a private sector loss absorption. Basically, when equity markets, for example, collapse, the losses are distributed. Typically, you don't have, except if you're in China, a taxpayer-funded bailout. And therefore, I think you have the same nationalistic obstacles. You have the same obstacles of inertia, of, you know, special interests. And Thomas alluded to that. And the special interests are both in the private sector and in the public sector, the agencies themselves. But I think you have a big element of obstacle to integration that was there in prudential banking supervision and isn't there in capital markets. The question then becomes, why did it happen in banking before capital markets? The reason, of course, is the Eurozone crisis. But when you look at the debates about supervisory integration in the early 21st century, actually everybody expected that supranational supervision would happen in capital markets before banking. So I think there's something there. Now, back to your question about securitization, and with apologies for this digression, securitization can be a powerful mechanism to help markets and not just banks. As you said, Rebecca, I guess one question is how powerful. So there seems to be a consensus forming, has not yet resulted in a decision. to reverse some of the regulatory obstacles to securitizations that were introduced at the beginning of the Great Financial Crisis, when you remember the subprime mortgage securitization in the US was identified as one of the problems, even though there was no exact equivalent in Europe. But my question to Thomas would be, how powerful would that be? Assume we make securitization basically as attractive as it can be in terms of regulation, how transformative would that be for European capital markets?
Right. If we go back 10 years or so, or even longer, the Commission was at that time coming forward with a fairly level-headed, practical solution to reining in the worst excesses of securitization. It got more stringent once the Council had decided upon that. But then it went to the European Parliament, and all the changes that were introduced by the European Parliament essentially killed off securitization in Europe. So what we are hopefully witnessing is coming back to a more level-headed, albeit cautious, system of securitization. Rebecca said all people talk about is how it gets stuff off bank balance sheets. Yes, but with balance sheets have two sides. So what you get off a bank's balance sheet pops up somewhere else as an asset, and that produces volume for European capital markets because you can slice it in different ways and directions than it would otherwise have been with a collection of thousands of little things on a bank balance sheet. You can slice it in different ways, and it can become a tradable asset, and thereby produce oomph to European capital markets, thereby producing something that we are really lacking, namely a long-term asset which is freely tradable. And I think that shows what one of the big problems in Europe is, to change the subject only slightly. The vast majority of Europeans, barring a couple of countries, prefer to keep their money in savings books, in bank accounts, i.e. short-term money. And what we need is to shift from the short-termism of European savers and European investors to long-termism of the European savers, European investors. That requires better financial education, a better regulatory framework, but it also requires that we have the products into which you can freely invest, not only at the national level, but cross-border. So coming back to securitization, anything that produces more market volume on the one hand and frees up bank balance sheets on the other hand is probably going to move us somewhat towards this, let's say, triple target of better saving and better investing, more long-termism, less short-termism in European capital markets.
I love how the intertwined nature of these things we're talking about shows how unified this collection of concepts is. It really is hard to talk about one without the other, and that's part of why Europe is trying to bring all of this together. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how to move forward and how to advance the single market, which is one of the big goals in all of this. Emmanuel Macron has called possibly for a coalition of the willing to move ahead on capital markets if there are other countries that are resistant. Thomas, you mentioned earlier that there's a huge variety of expertise and of market concentration from country to country. My feeling is that if you split up the single market, even with the best of intentions, it's going to be harder to put it together later on, and that the idea of creating building blocks can just as soon create walls that keep out members of the club from ever joining. How do we get past that? How do we move ahead?
True. It depends on where you cooperate at the regional level. Think, for example, about, let's say, technical standards. There you want pan-European solutions, and that's it. Anybody not being part of that would punch huge holes into the single market. Think, on the other hand, about rail transport or road transport, cross-border interconnectivity, and that is where regional cooperation or bilateral cooperation, plurilateral cooperation produces better results than if you go it alone. So there will be a number of areas, and I've recently been discussing this with Nicola, there will be a couple of areas where enhanced cooperation between a very limited number of countries would be counterproductive, as you said, if we set up separate entities, separate regulations, separate institutions, that would probably hinder European integration at a somewhat later stage. On the other hand, we would have a number of areas where cross-border cooperation simply produces a larger market, a more vibrant market, better access to capital, better access to information. Think, for example, about the venture capital industry. In Europe, a little known fact is that we have more startups than the United States, but they're smaller. They are spread across 27 member states, very little connection to each other. So what we'd probably want is have equity funds which cover not only one country, but a couple of countries in the region. We'd want better information across, for example, CEE. We'd probably want to see better cooperation between stock exchanges and the like. And that is something where if we strengthen, for example, intra-CEE cooperation, thereby strengthening intra-CEE capital markets, that's a bonus for all of the European Union and not just for the individual country concerned. But you're right, let's not pretend that setting up separate institutions, rules and regulations would be a positive way forward.
Nicola, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the idea of bypassing obstacles to EU-level decision-making and doing things more bottom-up with a number of member states involved is very appealing. A number of member states who want to make progress in capital markets union are discussing these options these days. Based on past experience, this has very little chance of actually happening because this is not the first time of when ideas of what is known to in the jargon as a 28th regime, for example, is being discussed, some things that could be optional. It's not exactly the same idea as enhanced cooperation of the number of member states going for something. In financial services, the track record of those ideas producing something useful is extremely low. And I think that's for a reason. And the reason is we have, as I said, we have a national level for financial services, a legacy from the past, very strong. We have a European level, which now is empowered on a number of dimensions. We have proofs of concept. Things that looked impossible 20 years ago are now a reality. It's difficult to invent something new. I think there is a force of attraction of those two levels that is greater than anything else that can be realistically done. The Nordic countries have considerably more mutual trust and ability to do things together than probably any other grouping of EU nations. Even so, Norway, of course, and Iceland are in that space, so it's not only the EU. They have joint embassy buildings. They have all kinds of things that other EU countries find impossible. They have tried to do things together in financial regulation. Ultimately, it has not taken off. And now, of course, Finland and the Baltic countries are in the Eurozone. They're part of European banking supervision. And the debates in Denmark and Sweden are whether or not to join that. And conversely, if you think of, for example, initiatives in taxation, which I think could be interesting, say, a joint tax-preferred product for investment in capital markets of this and that country. Why not, Germany and France? It is very appealing. I find it not implausible and seductive. At the same time, is any of the two parliaments, and especially the Bundestag, which has a lot of autonomy, going to bind itself to doing things unanimously with France or any other for the foreseeable future on a given, tax-defined product? I think it's more difficult than it sounds, frankly, and therefore... it's probably my lack of imagination, but I think doing things at the EU level makes sense. Doing things at the national level makes sense. The intermediate level doesn't have a great track record.
On taxes particularly, I'm coming around to the idea that this is a solvable problem with some financial sector and technological innovation. You can build a computer that will internalize all of the different withholding tax rules and pre-fill in your forms. And if you could create a good product, you can decide how much to charge for pre-doing all of the tax stuff and just taking care of it as we get better at building things. That seems like something that the market could build if there were a system that investors wanted to invest in. As we try to wrap up this conversation, because there are so many different areas we could move forward in, I keep coming back to the leaders and how they can decide that this is a priority when there's not a crisis. And the answer there will probably have to do with making Europe more competitive, because the European economy is stuck where the US economy has been more dynamic. And we also see that even without looking at Brexit, EU capital markets are just a place where people aren't coming. I mean, Nicola, you've written about how this initiative started as a way to maybe encourage the UK to stay in the EU. The EU left. But the new financial think tank numbers show that capital markets have been going down since 2006. So well before, as well as well after Brexit. Will that be enough to get them motivated? And will there be sort of a trust that market finance is a thing worth investing in and not just dictating?
So we're coming back to the debate we were having on, is it realistic to envisage a move forward on supervisory integration, which I think is really at the core of the agenda. And I think the answer is it's unrealistic, as we have seen in the last few years and months, if the decision is at the level of finance minister. It's even more unrealistic if it's at the level of national securities authorities. But it is realistic if it's at the level of national leaders. And when you look at how decisions were made to create the European Central Bank against the opposition of national central banks and national finance ministers, to create European banking supervision against the opposition of national supervisory authorities and most national finance ministers. I'm simplifying a more complex picture. I'm aware of that, but long story short, it was a chef's affair. It was a decision that was elevated to the level of head of state and government, and they could see beyond the inertia, the bureaucratic turf, the special interests, including very powerful special interests, by the way, because there was a greater good at stake. And I think in a way what we're discussing for Capital Markets Union is no different. I think if the issue gets elevated to the attention of heads of state and government, not just acknowledging a communique, but actually discussing it and understanding the issues at stake and the options, then there is hope. And as was mentioned before, I see a greater sense of urgency because we have war in Ukraine. We need to be able to mobilize resources. Because we have the climate transition, we need to be able to mobilize resources for that are not just budgetary for that. Because we have this picture, which is increasingly stark, of European business being left behind in the most dynamic segments of corporate growth, particularly, but not only in tech. And that's in part, not entirely, but in part because Wall Street is so attractive. Merit McGuinness, the European Commissioner in charge, wrote an article in the Financial Times, which is kind of her swan song, right? It's her farewell piece. I don't know if I'm fair to her by saying it's the first time she takes a public position in favor of integrated capital market supervision. She certainly does it in that piece. And she mentions what is called in the jargon the flips, companies that grow fast in Europe and then relocate to the US to get more accessible funding. That's exactly one of the drivers of Capital Markets Union for a political leader. Can we accept that this is our future? So I haven't lost hope. I think there is a chance that given this sense of urgency, given the obvious failure of 10 years of Capital Markets Union by trying to pick the so-called low-hanging fruits to deliver meaningful results, maybe the leaders will devote some attention to this issue.
That's a good point that Commissioner McGuinness has chosen supervision as her parting message when so much of her tenure has been focused on the individual files she was trying to get over the line. Thomas, your optimism has helped the euro area in particular get through so many crises so far. As you have continued to advise in your retirement from civil service. You're an official RISE person. Whenever they need a high-level opinion on this, they want you to help shepherd it. What would you like to leave our listeners with in terms of thinking about what's possible and where we should go from here?
Maybe continuing where Nicola left off. I think the problem with heads of state, but also finance ministers, is that they'd probably love to have a well-functioning capital markets union, but they very much dislike how to get there. And add a unhealthy dosis of lack of knowledge of this admittedly extremely, extremely complex dossier, and then you realize what the obstacles are that one needs to overcome. I would probably start with thinking about how do I personally save money for retirement? Do I, like the vast majority of Europeans, just keep it in a savings book, and especially with negative impact of inflation, and probably be losing something between 2, 3, 4, 5% of my savings every year? Do I just passively accept that, or do I start thinking about higher yield, more long-term, better thought-out ways of saving, which then ultimately would provide more funds for those companies which we'd love to retain in Europe? Everybody wants Birkenstock to be a European company. Where did the IPO happen? Not in Europe. So everything hangs together, as a good friend of mine from Washington used to say. And one can think about what should heads of state do, but one should also be thinking about what can I personally do to improve my personal financial situation, and thereby also, even though only marginally, contributing to better European financial markets. So the complexity of the whole issue is probably one of the largest obstacles.
Thank you, Thomas Wieser. Thank you, Nicolas Véran. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thomas is a former European official and leader of all of these groups. Nicolas is senior fellow at Bruegel. I am also a senior fellow at Bruegel and the Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. And you can find reports on CMU and opinion pieces and thoughts by all three of us on our website, Bruegel.org, where you can also find the archives of this podcast and many other interesting things. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been The Sound of Economics. Hope to see you next time.